Ever since his publication, Abolish Silicon Valley, How to Liberate Technology from Capitalism, has proven to be more urgent and insightful. Today, I talk with author Wendy Liu about how developments like AI and LLM, further erosions of intellectual property, and increased invasions of privacy make the case for abolishing Silicon Valley even more important. We especially talk about how abolition is crucial at a time when more and more of the private sector has come to eviscerate the public good. Turning to the genocide in Gaza, we talk about the ways capital has enlisted technology in a deadly and horrific manner. We end with a meditation on the commons and how one can live with fewer commodities and find value in common projects to make life more valuable and worthwhile outside the logic of the market. Speaking Out of Place is produced in collaboration with The Creative Process and is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. We hope you enjoy this and other episodes. Please help support Speaking Out of Place by subscribing via our website, speakingoutofplace.com, following us on Instagram, and following me on Blue Sky. You can give me your feedback, suggest people to invite, and topics to cover. Also, please check out my book of the same title, published by Haymarket Books. Kianga Yamata Taylor calls it, quote, the exact book we need for the troubled historical moment through which we are living. Thank you so much for being on the show, Wendy. I was thinking about how best to introduce you and your book to the audience, and I came across this amazing passage on page 189. It really gets to the heart of your argument. The beginning of it is, abolishing Silicon Valley means freeing the development of technology. And it ends with, time to leave the swamp of capital behind and start all over with something new. So would you mind reading that?
Yeah.
That'd be great. Yeah.
Okay, great. No, I love this. I think this chapter, especially like these two paragraphs, are just like the crux of my project. So I'm glad you picked this up.
Yeah.
Okay. Abolishing Silicon Valley means freeing the development of technology from a system that will always relegate it to a subordinate role, that of entrenching existing power relations. It means designing a new system that isn't deluged in the logic of the market. It means liberating our worlds from the illegitimate reign of capital. Perhaps this sounds unfair to capital. Perhaps I sound like I'm not grateful enough for everything that capital has given us. But we don't owe capital anything. The things we attribute to capital were built by workers, people who labored and sometimes died in the process. Their contributions unrecognized in death as in life. So don't thank capital. It doesn't deserve our gratitude and it doesn't need it anyway. Thank the people who created everything that capital always takes credit for. Capital is a means of accounting for wealth ownership, not its creation. And that means it's perpetually shrouded in a fundamental untruth. Time to leave the swamp of capital behind and start over with something new.
Beautiful. That's, again, it has so many of the elements that are important to so many of us. Do you want to take a few minutes and just scope back a little bit and unpack that before we get into more questions?
Yeah, that sounds good. It's funny, I haven't read this passage in so long, and I'm almost surprised reading. I'm like, oh, I guess I didn't say this.
Yeah, you forgot how good it is.
Glad you think so. No, I think in a way, this is the entirety of where this book comes from, right? This sets out the framework for the book. And I think for me to get to this point, in a way, it's such a basic insight. And I think it's something that a lot of people already know intuitively that I unfortunately just didn't, because I had bought into this Silicon Valley dream, this idea that the way wealth was owned and distributed in Silicon Valley was somehow fair. And I think it's deeply entwined with the idea of meritocracy.
Yeah.
And it's very fickle, very strange and slippery idea. But I think because I believed it, everything else seemed justified. And I could look at wealth inequality and think, okay, yeah, that makes sense. There's something legitimate there. You need to motivate people to work harder. Sure, that makes sense. But there was always some slippage, something that didn't feel quite right. And I think the process of me getting to the point where I could write a passage like that, I really had to unlearn all these things that I had internalized through my time absorbing the culture of Silicon Valley. Because I think the entirety of Silicon Valley is built on the idea that the opposite of what I was writing in this book, it's built on the idea that if you come up with a great idea, then you deserve to own all this wealth that flows from that idea, even if you're no longer involved in creation of it after a while. And there's this strange, almost sleight of hand where it's like, we all know that the people who are doing the actual work that keeps the world going, we understand that they're not actually getting the full fruits of their labor. But we just take it for granted that that's fine. That's normal. This is a trick that capitalism is playing on us, that this is something we should accept as somehow fair or efficient. And I think what I'm trying to get at with this passage is that we should really rethink that, and that we need a system that doesn't distribute wealth in this manner. And I think that's a hard thing to get to when we're living in this world that encourages us to behave in a certain way, encourages us to behave as the entrepreneurial subject and try to the rise and grind hustle culture, Silicon Valley. I think there's such a disconnect between the ideology of this industry and the reality of what the world should be like. So I think that's where this book came from. And the book is mostly structured as a memoir, which I think is surprising to people who look at the cover page and they see it as maybe some kind of manifesto, some rant. And there are elements of that for sure. But I wanted to take people through my own journey of of being able to write a book like this, because it was not a given. And there's an alternate world where I stayed within the path that I was on and I maybe even became somewhat successful. And I wouldn't have gotten to the realizations I did. And I think in that way, I'm so grateful for the failure of my startup, because that failure was what allowed me to, I think, really see the world that it was and not keep living in this fantasy world where the only thing that mattered was my own success and my own sort of narcissistic need to become powerful and wealthy and get recognition for what I was doing. I think once I left that bubble, then it's like everything else made sense again. It's like I couldn't go back to the way it was, and I couldn't help but see the world differently. And I guess that's what inspired me to want to write a book, to try to help other people who are in a similar place as me understand this thing that I think people are missing when they're inside that bubble.
And I'm so glad you wrote it as a biography, because that's what convinces people. It's not talking down to them, it's talking across to them from your own personal experience. And you mentioned so many things. I'm going to try to get together one question, or maybe a series of questions in the general area. And it centers on that word that you mentioned, meritocracy. And just for our audience, Wendy gave a talk here at Stanford a few months ago, and the book came out 4 years ago or so, but the audience was just enraptured, from what I understand, from reports I heard, which meant it's still so salient. And you were tapping into beliefs that haven't waned a lot since you wrote this. And I think especially you and I share part of a last name. Liu is like the Smith of Chinese. You can't miss us. So we're related. Go back to the Han Dynasty. You'll find our human relative. Both come as children of immigrants. And so the idea of meritocracy has a particular salience, right? You come to the country and you become part of it through your effort to be part of a workforce. And then, oddly enough, it segments into exactly what you talk about, that you want to be successful, even if it means forgetting what your success is based upon in terms of other people, right? It's your own doing. It's this pick yourself up from your bootstraps individualism that America is horrible and slash great at. So could you talk a little bit about how you came to this realization? Because I thought it was interesting that you started off having this huge offer from Google, right? And you went to the camp and you were given all the swag. And I've been to the camp, so I understand, you know, what it's all about. And it is seductive. And the buzz and the atmosphere of, hey, we're here and it's great and we're going to save the world, all these things. And then you decided, no, you wanted to show your individual talent even more through a startup, right? And then that failed to your good fortune. So could you talk a little bit more about this experience of inheriting certain kinds of values and then investing in the startup and then finding those values were vividly brought into contradiction with capital?
No, that's a wonderful question. And I'll start with a bit about the immigrant experience. So I think there's a sense in which being an immigrant to a place that feels vaster than you, that, you know, where you just feel like you're a little ant and you're entering something so much bigger than you can't comprehend it. All you can do, the best you can hope for, is to try to assimilate, just try to find a little place for yourself within it. You can't really question the system. That's not, it doesn't seem meaningful. Like, why would I do that? I have nothing.
And it also seems rude. It seems ungrateful, right?
Exactly. And I think there's a parallel with the experience of a college student who's just about to graduate and trying to find their way in the workforce. And this is something that came up in the discussion with those Stanford students who were, that was an amazing conversation. I feel so grateful to be able to talk to the students and hear their perspectives. But I think there's a sense in which you're graduating, you look at the world of jobs as this giant institution, this machinery, this complex landscape, like you don't really understand that you couldn't, you can't even conceive of trying to change it. You just think of yourself as, oh, if I'm lucky, I'll find a place. And then I'll figure out what I'm doing from there. I think there's some parallels there. And I think it's a very common path. And I definitely felt that for a long time. And I think for me, the way I was able to see things differently, I think a lot of it came from reading history and especially being turned on to this idea of labor history and collective action and change, where it's not just you as an individual trying to mark a place for yourself in the world, right? It's realizing that when you and other workers in a similar position come together, you can actually change the balance of power. You can actually change what's possible on a much larger scale than you could change as an individual. And I think that really opened things up for me. And it changed the idea of agency, because I think before I didn't really think of myself as having any agency except in being able to carve out a path for myself. And then, but this idea of collective agency that I became familiar with through reading history that centered on collective action and just people coming together and questioning the system as it was, I think that opened something up for me and made me realize that there's a different path, right? There's a different way of seeing the world. There's a different way of seeing your responsibility to the world and to other people. And I think once you see things that way, it's really hard to just take the world as given and to try to find your place in it, especially when you understand just how morally compromised the world is as it is now. And I think this is something that definitely came up in the conversation with the students, where, of course, a lot of the students at Stanford had participated in some of the pro-Palestinian activism that was happening. And I think we see a lot of that in the tech industry as well. A lot of people who work in tech have been taking action against their employer to protest specifically their employer's work with Israel. And we're seeing similar things with ICE, with the Department of Defense. I feel like the last few years, we've seen a lot of action from students, from workers, in terms of protesting the immoral conduct of their employers. So I think that, to me, speaks to this recognition that collective action is a lever for change, for recognizing that you don't have to take the world as given. You don't have to be passive. You don't have to just find a place for yourself and let the world take you. You can have a worldview. You can have a sort of moral compass that you pay attention to. And when you see that things are not quite right, there's something you can do to try to change that. And I think that feels so much more empowering to me as a person. It's so much more fulfilling than simply trying to carve out a place for myself in this world that I see as morally compromised.
Yeah, that's a great answer. So I'm going to ask you the, it's no longer million, billion dollar question, which is, how did you come to pick up a history book? You were so dedicated and devoted, as you should be, startup to tech.
It's so funny in a way, because it feels so random. I think it was bound to happen at some point. But I guess the background context of this is that my startup was going through a pretty difficult time in 2016. And this was partly due to Cambridge Analytica. The scandal had happened. Yeah. And as a result, all these tech companies were shutting down their platform. There was more attention paid to privacy. And because the startup had existed in this weird gray area where we could really violate people's privacy and make a lot of money from it, and that a lot of other startups were doing at the same time, we thought we could just scrape by on that forever. And then when the scandal happened and there was all that backlash, we realized we couldn't keep doing this. Our business model was coming to an end. We had to find something new. And so we had this whole summer, this endless, aimless summer, where we're just throwing ideas out at each other, trying to, robotics, healthcare, whatever. We were just so full of hubris. We really thought that we're brilliant tech people. We can do anything. We can solve all the problems of the world. And it became clear to me over the course of this summer, there was a divergence between, so there were three of us. One of us, he just had a very different idea of what mattered and different values. And so there's two of us on one side and the one on the other. And we couldn't really agree on anything. Yeah. And in this moment, the startup itself, we didn't really have to do much. So we're just talking, reading stuff. And I just had all this idle time. And I just had this kind of a strange realization that, oh, it's like, I haven't actually read that many books. At the time I was living in Montreal, I lived really close to one of the biggest libraries in Canada, the Quebecois National Library. And I thought, I used to read a lot when I was young. And I've just been immersed in this startup that I haven't really been reading. At the same time, the Trump campaign was in full swing.
Yeah.
Brexit was happening. Just all these things were happening in the world. The European debt crisis was also vaguely in my peripheral vision. I just had this feeling of, I've been so immersed in a startup that isn't even working out. This isn't going anywhere. It's a dead end. And I've been not paying attention to anything else in the world. And I don't know what's going on. I don't know what's going on with the rest of the world. And I just had this feeling that I needed to start paying attention more. And on the one hand, I was starting to read more news. I was looking at alternative sources. I was starting to find more left-wing sources. At the same time, I would just go to the library. And I would randomly walk through the different aisles and look at books on the shelf and think, oh, this looks interesting. I would just grab random books. There was definitely a lot of randomness involved, not a lot of structure. But then over time, as I figured something out, I felt like I was on a path. I was like sniffing out a path that made sense. And a lot of that actually came from literature, because I was reading David Foster Wallace, and I really loved the way his writing made me feel and think. And I just had this thought, oh, I should try to understand how he does this. Who's writing the literary criticism about this person? And so I started reading that. And I remember this moment where I was reading the literary criticism about his work, and some of the people who write about David Foster Wallace are just these like really brilliant theorists and thinkers who really understood so much more about how the world worked than I did, I could tell. And I remember reading this one essay that mentioned the word neoliberalism, and which is a word I'd started to see online and like articles, but I didn't really know what it meant. And I thought, okay, there's some unified thing here. Like, these people are talking about the same thing. I don't understand what this is. I should understand what this is, right? I think I'm a smart person. I should know this, what this means. I shouldn't just be so singular in my experience of the world that all I understand is tech, right? I want to be a more well-rounded individual. And so I just had this feeling that I was missing something important about the world if I just kept being a software engineer immersed in the startup that was failing. And so I really allowed myself to broaden my reading and to just keep reading and to follow these threads. And that led me to a master's degree at the London School of Economics on the topic of inequality. I'm really glad I did it. I think what was even more meaningful than the degree was just being in London at a time when there was the Corbyn campaign was in full swing. There were all these protests happening. There were all these strikes that were going on. A lot of lecturers were going on strike. There were gig economy organizing attempts, and all these things were happening. And I realized that all these ideas that I've been reading about in books, critiquing the way the world was, offering solutions, these histories I was reading, they weren't dead. They weren't just words on a page. They were alive and connected to the activities going on around me. And so I just felt like I had no choice but to try to understand more. And so, you know, I really opened up and I decided I'm going to try going to this protest. I'm going to try writing for this online magazine. I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to do that thing. I'm going to go to this talk. I'm going to make friends who are in this political world. And so that, I think that for me was what changed everything. And then I realized this is my life now. I can't go back. There's no part of me that really wants to go back to what I was doing before, because that felt like a smaller, worse version of me. Yeah. And I felt like I was blossoming for the first time and really understanding what I cared about in the world and what I wanted to do.
Yeah. Now, I think the students, not only the students that you met here, but students in general who are interested in tech and computer science and whatnot, many of them are experiencing something very similar when they see the genocide in Gaza. This is a world historical event, and they are looking for a language, a body of knowledge, a way of explaining this, not necessarily to be an activist, but just because they can't morally ignore it. They can't sit with not knowing. And a lot of it also happens because they will get into arguments or heated discussions with other people, and they will want to know what they're talking about as being responsible. So I think that's one thing that's quite encouraging in some ways. And here at Stanford, the Asian American students, their organization is one of the most together on Palestine I've ever seen. They're very well organized and thoughtful. And so I think your experience is not unusual and hopefully will become less and less unusual. You talk about how much you really enjoy technology. You don't have any qualms about that. And you have a really interesting passage. I'll read it to you since you already read something. It's on 165. It's not to say that these products should exist or that they should only be built outside the technology industry. It's to say that the implicit profit motive that directs the industry's operation is a bad fit for technological development. Not only does the influx of capital poison the usual products by encouraging them to sell out, but it also inflates the valuations of these less useful companies. Could you talk more about this? Because you really love the idea of inventing something and bringing something to production, and then you see it just completely hijacked by capital.
Definitely. And just to tie this together to your earlier point, I think that what we're seeing with the genocide is that people are realizing that there's this tension between the moral values they have, what they want in the world, and what the logic of capital is creating for all of us, right? There's this kind of contradiction that doesn't really make sense. And how do you resolve this idea that on the one hand, we don't want children to be bombed, right? We don't want this. But we exist in a system where that is the logical conclusion of the logic of profit and capital accumulation. Like, this is what the end result is. And it is all perfectly logical and rational. And you can't really argue with it because this is maximizing shareholder value, whatever. This is maximizing the interests of the U.S. military, whatever, right? So you have this like very rational system where everything makes perfect sense and it's all logical and all the axioms line up and it's fine. But then we see the results and we look at the result and like, this is awful. We don't want this. And then what do you do? And then you have to abandon one or the other. I hope that more people choose to abandon their ideological commitment to the system rather than abandoning their moral values. But I think, unfortunately, there's a certain amount of abandonment of one's moral values that is being asked of us just to be in the system, just participate. And to that point, I think maybe that's like a useful background context for what I was trying to write here. I love writing code, right? I still do. And I think a lot of people who work in the industry do on some level enjoy it. And I think it's a beautiful craft. It's something that can create a lot of value in the world. Value and not in the
in a real way. Yes.
An actual benefit, maybe. And at the same time, a lot of what the creation of software is being used for now is just for these purposes that are either so mundane or so sinister. I think that's what's really frustrating about it, right? Because with the ability to write software comes the ability to create something completely new and beautiful and helpful and beneficial. But for the most part, I don't think this energy is being directed in a way that is actually helpful overall. If we look at just where is this industry going overall, we're seeing right now in the middle of an AI hype cycle, right, where we see all this energy, all this money being directed into products that are enterprise AI or consumer-grade AI or something. And it's unclear, does this offer any actual benefit? Is this what people actually need or want? Or is this just an excuse to fire people and replace them with subpar versions of themselves that are just AI and therefore no human is making any money from the people who founded the startup, right? It's just a way to funnel wealth into fewer and fewer hands. Is that the outcome? And I think people who are in the industry can talk a lofty game about how they're trying to free up human labor, they're trying to automate drudgery or whatever, but is that really what's happening? And is that actually the useful thing to do in a system where the people whose jobs will be automated away will simply suffer? Is, I think there's an ethical question here about maybe in the abstract sense, this technology is beneficial to humanity, but if it's going to be used by people who you cannot trust, if it's going to be subjected to market forces in a way that will only harm people, then the ethical question is, should you even write this at all? And I think that's a question that people aren't asking enough.
Yeah, I'm going on sort of an AI binge now because I had Sarah Roberts on before talking about your AI is human. And then I have Karen Howe in the next month about her new book. But when we look at the hype around AI, it's exactly what Sarah says. There are all sorts of humans involved. They're being exploited at the base of this and exploited in horrible ways that are psychically devastating. And then the environmental cost is just astronomical. It's not this cloud floating around, but it's grounded and it's wired and it's sucking up huge amounts of energy for a product that we don't really know is that infallible. In fact, it's probably hugely fallible, but then it gets back to our tolerance for error. We're so entranced with the possibility that we'll accept all the bad shit that's coming down the pike. So it must be, in a way, heartbreaking to you as somebody in tech. And you talk about this at the end of the book, but why don't we talk about it now? What ways can we think about technology that have human value, not value as per capital?
On the point about AI, I think what we're seeing now is this very top-down imposition of software into our lives. And you really see this in the commercials for AI during the Super Bowl or just on TV or whatever, where it's almost like the actors in these commercials, it's like they're themselves AI.
Exactly.
In a way that doesn't make any sense. They'll be like, hey, AI, whatever, make a reservation for me at a restaurant and that does XYZ and order for me or something. It's like, that's not how people behave. But there's this very strange, just top-down vision of how humans should behave imposed on us and given to us as if this is something we're asking for. But
in fact, what intelligence is.
Yeah, exactly. What is this world being given to us? And who wants this? Is there anyone in the world who actually wants to interact with the world this way besides the tech people who worked on it? It's a very strange, unrepresentative, I think, anti-human way of relating to the world. And to your question of what could tech look like, I think, honestly, I don't even know. I don't even know because I think we're so enmeshed in this world where the vast majority of the technology developments that we see are created in this top-down way and imposed upon us by companies that are just trying to make money off of it through various devious means. Even if they have this lofty mission statement about how they're really trying to make the world a better place and do X, Y, Z, I mean, the goal is to make money. And that goes back to the quote that you read from my book. You know, you're driven at the end of the day by the profit motive. That really limits what's possible, I think. And that shapes, unfortunately, infects the minds of people who are working on the software. Maybe they even really believe themselves that they're working on something that is for the betterment of humanity. They don't see how they've been completely warped by this financial incentive. So yeah, I don't even know what technology could look like if those felt differently. I think I see glimpses of it. For example, these efforts to try to poison AI models, I think that's beautiful. I think, unfortunately, right now, a lot of this effort is more defensive. That creating something new, just because that is the place we're in. We are fighting a war, really, against technology that is being foisted upon us, capital. And maybe the best thing we can do right now is to try to push back little by little, right? Poison these models, find ways to just to resist whatever that looks like, to circumvent unfair regulations. And intellectual property law, I think, is something that's really interesting. Right? Yeah. You mentioned you wanted to talk about. I think there's a lot of creative energy right now in finding ways to circumvent intellectual property law by people who are trying to share things that maybe would belong to a commons, or that in a fairer world we would see as part of a commons, right? Like cultural output, scientific output that right now is being gated. And in the case of academic publications, right, it's being gated in a way that isn't even beneficial to the academics.
Absolutely not.
And I think there's so much creative energy there that's really inspiring. I think on the other hand, the interesting thing about intellectual property is you can see how capital will use IP law to its benefit when it wants to, and it will also completely jettison the idea of it when it doesn't want to. It's like you see this with these AI companies that have trained their models on data that is protected by copyright, but then they try to find a way to scrape those laws, and they say, oh, it's fine. It's just raw material. We're not really using it. And it's funny how it's these laws, you can really just see how fickle they are. These are not ironclad laws. These are not laws of nature. These are laws that were created by people in power and can be taken away by those in power if they don't want to be held back by them. It's interesting because I'm someone who has had a strong critique of intellectual property as it is now for a very long time. But at this moment, seeing the way these AI companies are trying to skirt intellectual property law to be able to have higher valuations, to be able to have higher profit margins, I think, we need to strengthen intellectual property law. So it's like a very strange place to be.
No, I think you hit nail on the head when you talk about it should be bottom up, not top down. If the property is decided upon by the bottom and shared rather than imposed erratically, capriciously by the top, that's something else. And I think something that abolition is all about, getting back to what good tech look like, abolition isn't obliged to come up with another system. It's obliged to show the deficiency, if not real damage, of the current systems and imagine other ways of being that are not necessarily encased in hard systems or rules or propriety, but rather having that space for us to, the space and time for us to deliberate together about what it might look like. And I think that, again, you talked about the commons, which you do in the book as well, which I thought was really the best place to start, because it's the thing that's precisely being torn apart most viciously right now with Doge and all these other attempts to rob the public and to make us dependent more and more on the private. Do you have any thoughts about what around you right now that gives you, I don't want to use the word hope, but gives you inklings of other kinds of ways of being in the world, or ways that people are beginning to register how important those things are? If you understand, they may not be actual manifestations, but rather you get the sense that people are saying, no, there's got to be a better world, because this one is, we've given it all the chances we have and we don't have any more chances, right?
Yeah. To your point about abolition, I think it's I feel like there's always a burden on critics of the system to try to offer, like you said, like this wholesale alternative, which I don't think is fair. And I don't think it makes sense, because it's not like the current system evolved just in one day, was like given to us. The current system evolved over time. And it was a series of choices that led to how it is now. And I think any new system as well, like, things will change over time, and you can't see the end result just from where we are now. So I think, it is an unfair burden that critics are asked to come up with an answer for everything. It's just not really feasible. But yeah, to your point about glimpses of something better, I don't know. Yeah, I wish I had a better answer for this. I think right now I'm in just this kind of defensive mode where I just look at everything and I just see how dreadful things are. And it's really hard to look past that. I think I definitely see hope and inspiration in the way that people are resisting those, yep, the protests in Los Angeles, especially against ICE.
Yep.
The fact that people burned Waymos, I thought that was beautiful and brilliant. I think it speaks to this recognition that all these things are entwined, that all these systems, the tech industry, and this really heavily militarized current US regime, like these are all, they're all part of the same, yeah, thing. They're all part of a system that is deeply anti-human and is trying to take away the things that give us meaning and purpose in life. And I think anything that reads to me like a response to that, a sort of alternative that I will find inspiring and hopeful. And I don't know, I think a lot of people are trying to live their lives in ways that are divorced from this just awful system of, yeah, profit and violence and misery. And I think anytime someone tries to, this is going to sound so silly and mundane, but against a world that is trying to commodify our every interaction and make everything into something you do on an app where, mm-hmm, there's a credit card being processed by Stripe in the background. I think any attempt people make to do something outside of that, right? Just, yeah, to give a friend a ride to the airport, drop off some soup at a friend's house when they're sick, instead of using DoorDash, instead of using Uber. I think any attempt that is grounded in love and solidarity and community, to show up for the people around you, not expecting anything in return, anything that's just motivated by this recognition that it's nice to be human. It's nice to be around other humans. It's nice to give freely.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. It's to not subject yourself to the forces of entrepreneurship and feeling like you have to be making money all the time, like you have to be rising and grinding and hustling and being efficient and optimizing for everything. I think that to me is a way to resist the, yeah, world, a way to take yourself out of that and put yourself in the right frame of mind. I think, again, going back to the event at Stanford and talking to these students, I really feel like there has been a shift since I was in college, and that students, even at a place like Stanford, students really understand now just how sinister the tech industry has become and the whole corporate world has become. And they're aware of this idea of career funneling, right? And they're trying to find ways around that. And I think that to me feels very hopeful and beautiful, that people are looking at the world as it is and they're saying, no, I don't want to participate in that. I want to try to shift it. I want to try to make something else with my life. I think for me, when I look at that, it just took me so long to get to that realization, right? It was so hard won, and it really felt like it only came to me at this rock bottom moment. And I don't want other people to go through that.
Yeah.
But so it's really inspiring to see that people have gone to that realization much younger. And just by looking at the world and talking to people around them, and it does feel like more people are able to carve out lives for themselves that don't involve simply passively participating in this industry that they have a critique of. And I think something that came up in the conversation with the students was this idea of how much do you really need to live? What, mm-hmm, do you really need to survive?
No.
Because I think we're all in this world that is bombarding us with this idea that we need a lot. There's advertisements everywhere telling you you need this fancy credit card. You need to travel to this place. You need to buy this. You need to buy that. You need to live in a fancy condo that costs, I don't know, like $2 million, whatever. And in order to afford all these things that you need to take a job at Palantir or, yeah, whatever it is, right? It's like you need to compromise on your values just to be able to afford the likes that you need. And I think it's so important to question all of these things and to ask yourself, what do I really need? How much, yeah, money do I really need to get by? How can I make something work that feels more true to my values in this world? And how do I resist the messaging that's, mm-hmm, all around me in this world? And I think part of that comes from surrounding yourself with people who believe the same or at least similar things as you, who have a similar, yeah, commitment to the moral compass that you have, and who are also in this project of trying to figure out how do I carve a space for myself in this world that feels increasingly dark and heavy and rigid. But because I think there is always more space than you think, and it's not always going to be easy, but something for me that I'm always thinking about is going to be a little dark, but it's just this, I just have this really heavy sense of my own mortality at all times. And I always ask myself, is this, how do I want to live my life? I don't have that much time on this world.
I wake up every morning with the same questions, but you have a bit of time.
Maybe, you never know, right? I have a friend who's my age who has cancer.
Yeah.
And I think spending time with her has made me think about this, yeah, pretty. Yeah.
This is something that, yeah, Dean Spade talks about all the time. There's so much that you said there that I wanted to engage with. One is that being here at Stanford, I go through some of these writings by Leland Stanford, and he has this one, I should send it to you. It's when he's deciding that because education has done so well at making men, quote unquote, capable of running businesses, you don't need a big capitalist anymore. He's really interested in miners' unions. And he didn't really mean unions, but rather consortia, right? But in any case, this a speech he's going to give to Congress. He's a senator at the point, and he wants support for these consortia. And he says, in terms of capitalism, we're at such a great stage. And look, we can provide for anybody's needs, any need you could imagine. And then he says, and just by a point of comparison, look at these Native Americans. They're slothful and indolent. And the problem with it, they don't need anything. He says, they don't need anything. They're totally useless. And they're a sign of an age of mankind that we've thankfully left behind. I also wanted to talk about, when you mentioned ICE, the last episode I uploaded was with Mel Buer, who was at MacArthur Park during that phony, stupid military invasion. And she, at the end of the interview, she talks about these mutual support groups, exactly what you're talking about, and bringing soup. And they said, sharing medical care, taking care of pets, each other's pets. All these things show that we don't need these big official structures that are going to exploit us. We can take care of ourselves, but we've been trained to always imagine that we can't do that, or that it would be of lesser quality or importance. And the other thing in terms of giving me hope is the statistics about how even Republicans are now thinking that immigrants are okay. And this is a sea change after the intense propaganda machine that Trump put out, naming them as being the source of all evil. I think people are realizing that when they're missing people that they used to see on the street, or you just come and take care of them or help their mother with their shopping, we're all integrated into this really important social fabric. And you can't tear off one part of it for whatever reason and expect the society and the world that you had before to exist. I just had two more questions. I'd be interested in you telling us what you're up to these days. And then what would you say to a young person?
Great question. Just to maybe quickly jump back to what you were saying.
Please.
Yeah. This kind of answers one of the questions. Yeah, I loved that quote. I think capitalism requires us all to be these good subjects, right? These good neoliberal subjects, consumers, workers, well-behaved. We have to need things. We have to turn that need into this desire to show up at work and collect our paychecks. And maybe one way to disrupt the system is to be a bad subject. Maybe that looks like realizing that you actually don't need as much as you think you need. And it's just such a small, simple thing. It was like, maybe you don't need all these things that money can theoretically buy for you. Maybe you find other ways to get your needs met. And maybe that looks like finding these sort of non-commodified spaces. And I'm really interested in tenant organizing. I've been following a lot of that. And there's this amazing book called Abolish Rent. I don't know if you're familiar with this already. But it's a wonderful summary of lessons learned from tenant organizing campaigns in LA. And I think if I think about that and think about all these ways that people have found these non-commercial ways to provide the things that they need for themselves and each other. And this metaphor that I keep thinking of is, imagine a canoe. And it's like there's all these holes, and all these holes are just like the force of capital rushing in to sink the canoe. But you can patch the holes. Yeah. And every time you patch a hole, it's just one less hole that capital can make its way through. And I think those holes look like, how do you, just I was saying earlier, how do you make food for your friends who are sick? How do you, or your friends or family, your neighbors? How do you give people rides? How do you watch other people's pets so that they don't have to turn to a service like Rover?
Yeah.
And of course, there are these things that we can't really do in that way. Like healthcare for now, unfortunately, is something that we mostly have to turn to this outside system for. But there's so many things in between that I think if you chip away at the parts of the world that capital is trying to seep into, then you make your community stronger and you learn to provide for yourself and you stop these companies from coming in and insinuating themselves into your lives.
Yeah.
I think that's something that we can all do on an individual level as much as we can. And then to your question of what I'm up to now, I'm just trying to survive for the most part, but I'm writing. So I'm working on, I have a novel that I'm working on.
Oh, wow.
That is, if you can imagine like a novel version of this book, but
Well,
I would say more ambitious because I want to capture all the things I've learned since the book came out, right? Mm-hmm. And I've realized that the best way for me to talk about these things is to have them in fictional forms. I think what I loved most about writing my memoir, it was just the memoir elements, the personal story. But there's a limit to how far my own personal story can go and how mm-hmm. I can find insights on that. Because of that, I've been thinking about, I'm imagining, what if someone had a startup that was a lot more successful? Mm-hmm. And then what would it take for them to learn the lessons that I've learned, or were that successful? Yeah. And then at the same time, I'm imagining, what would it take for there to be another general strike in San Francisco? Because there was one in like 90 years ago. And I think people couldn't really imagine that something like that would happen. And today, of course, we're living in an era when it feels even harder to imagine something like a general strike in the city. But I think we need to. And I think that imaginary can help us maybe challenge our idea of what the world has to look like. And so this novel that I'm working on, it's partly about the tech industry and startups and venture capital, but it's also about the world of work and what does contemporary labor in San Francisco look like? Yeah. And what would happen if enough people were to say, hold on, we don't like things the way they are. We're going to put a wrench in the works and we're going to walk off the job and have these demands. And what happens if that starts to build? What would that look like? And how would that challenge our ideas of what's fair and what's just and what a meaningful life looks like? So that's what I'm working on with the novel. It's going slowly, trying to just chip away at it as much as I can. In the meantime, I'm still writing nonfiction, working on a project about billboards. That's the fun thing that I've been working on. I'm working on a second essay about that. The first essay came out a few weeks ago for Bay Area Current, which is a new Bay Area-based working class publication that just launched online only. So the billboards thing is my new thing. I've just been paying attention to the tech billboards in the city for a long time.
Yeah.
And I just felt, who's writing about this? Because there's something.
Oh, what a great project.
It's so weird, right? Because you just see, you walk around and you see all these ads that are just for some sort of AI startup that a vast majority of people could not even understand, much less hope to buy. And there's something really jarring about living in a city where most of essentially the public art that you see is this weird commercial enterprise software slog. So I've been working on a column about that, and I'm going to be hopefully writing more about all the different kinds of billboards that come out. Right now I'm working on a piece about the Stop Hiring Humans billboards that I'm loving. Yeah, it's for this AI company, and there's like a picture of this AI generated woman. And her name is Ava. And the idea is that you can hire Ava instead to do what your human employees would do, which is really fake, honestly. I looked into this company. It's a very mundane company that only it does scale automation. It's very basic. It's nothing close to this all-purpose human assistant. But I think the company is riding on this wave of fear about AI. And so people look at that and they think, oh, no, this must be real. And I think investors look at it and they think, great. Good place for me to park my money. And so I want to talk about this phenomenon and what it means and how we should think about it. So yeah, that's what I'm working on now. And then to your other question, what would I say?
Before we get to that one, you just gave us a bunch of stuff to talk about because I love the premise of the novel because it's like the path not taken. What if you're starting at, so it gives you your Wendy, another incarnation. You know, what would I have been if this or that? And there's a great story by Henry James called The Jolly Corner. Which you should read. It's really about a guy who's haunted by the ghost of what he could have been if he had. And it's all about real estate, actually. So we can talk more about that. Okay. The second thing is, you must know Chris Carlson.
Of course, yeah.
Okay, yeah. I had him on to talk about When Shells Crumble, and I just did a gig with him like a couple months ago and about exactly those projects that you're talking about in terms of Bay Area Currents. So I'm glad I assumed you would know each other, but it sounds so perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. He organized an event at GPSF where myself and Aaron McElroy of the Anti-Eviction Mapping Project, we talked about our respective books. Aaron has a book called Silicon Valley Imperialism. And I talked about my book and it was really interesting. And Chris is great. I love the community that he organizes.
Yeah.
And then, I will definitely check out that book. That sounds amazing. And then, what advice would I give to a young person? Just continuing the themes of everything we talked about, I would say, try to look at the world as a thing that you can shape, right? Which seems so impossible because the world seems so big and vast and complicated and impermeable. But I think it's so important to get to the point where you can see not only that the world is something that was made up by people just like you, right? But that it's something that you can shape into something better than it is. And that's not something you can do alone. That's not really a project that you should just put on your shoulders by yourself. I think that's a project that you can do in consortium with other people who are in a similar position, whatever that looks like. Maybe you start something new. Maybe you get involved in a union of some kind, like tenant organizing or organizing with your coworkers or organizing a political movement, whatever it is. I think there's so much value in seeing yourself as part of history, as part of a collective history. And I think I would say seek out books about the history of other people who've tried to do similar things, and seek out community and figure out what your moral compass is telling you about the world that you're in and what direction it's pointing you into, and really ask yourself what you want to do with the limited time you have on Earth. Because when I think about what, and like you said, of course, it's maybe silly for me to be thinking about it in this way, but just can't help it. I look at the world and everything just feels so fragile and ephemeral. And I know that, and I try to really hold on to every moment that I have, because I don't know how many more any of us have.
Yeah.
But then I look at it and I think, how would I want to spend the rest of my time? I don't want to spend it just feeling like a consumer. I don't want my legacy to be that I consumed a lot of expensive goods that capital was pushing on me in the form of billboards and Instagram ads and whatever. That doesn't really feel meaningful. And I think about what is meaningful. What is meaningful is spending time with loved ones. What is meaningful is trying to write something that hopefully resonates with people about the things I care about. What is meaningful is trying to organize with other people and create a shift in whatever small corner of the world I can. And I think those are the things that feel meaningful to me. I think because of that, I've had to make some hard choices about how I want to spend my life. And there are sacrifices to make along the way. But I think it's worth it, because I know that what I want for my life is, I don't want to feel like I'm just a cog in a machine that I don't believe in. I don't want to feel like I have to make these moral compromises every day showing up to work. And instead, I work in service, right? I pay the bills by working at two different bars. And it's what that does for me is it frees me up and it gives me the time and space to write and without having to feel like all my creative energy is going towards my job. I think that's the choice I made. I think everyone else has a different sort of options in front of them. But for me, I came to this point after realizing that I didn't want the path that I thought I wanted, the one that had been sketched out for me by just the media, the narrative I inherited about what I should be doing with my life as a software engineer. I realized I didn't actually want that path. And again, I guess my advice for a young person is don't treat the world as given. Treat it as something that you can make for yourself. And you'll have to be realistic about what's actually possible. But there's so much more that's possible than you think. And whatever path you carve out for yourself, it just has to be one that you feel good living, because you're the one who has to live it. And then so you just have to find something that makes sense for you based on your moral compass. And then, hopefully you'll find a way to organize with other people to shape your world into something that you're happy with, you're happy living in.
That's a wonderful and beautiful and capacious answer. The only thing I would add is also understand flux and flexibility. Mm-hmm. What will feel right at a moment may feel slightly different in another one. But as one, again, way older, you develop through all those bumps and turns and twists a center of gravity. Whatever flux is rotating around this, you still have a center of gravity. You know who you are. But it's been such a pleasure to meet you and have you on the show. And please promise me you'll come back again and talk about billboards and novels and anything else that you want to talk about. One of the few things where I have independence is this podcast, because it's totally a one-person show and I'm having just a ball doing it. So thank you so much for being on.
Thank you for having me on. This has been such a pleasure. And I felt really inspired by this conversation.
Great. Me too. Okay. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.